Mr. Rucker was so new to our congregation, Norma would be giving him a summary of who I was, how much I gave to the church, and her own assessment of my standing in the community. And I knew what she thought of me, pretty much the same as I thought of her. Finally, Norma returned, walked slowly to her desk, and took her seat, carefully smoothing her skirt behind her before settling in. "He's very busy," she said, "but he can see you for a few minutes. You might note, Miss Julia, that he tries to be available to the members' concerns, even," she said with a sniff, "if they are minor ones blown out of proportion." "Norma," I said, so angered that I could barely control my voice, "I do hope that you have a good retirement plan, because you're going to need it." Then I walked into the pastor's office, closed the door behind me, and quickly took note of the room. It was pretty much the same as when Pastor Ledbetter had occupied it, but I had noticed on the budget an item for refurbishment of the pastor's study. I made a mental note to specifically designate my pledge for items of which I approved, and refurbishing the pastor's personal space was not one of them. The room was perfectly fine. In no way was it worn or soiled, and the only reason to redo it would be to change the color scheme. As far as I was concerned, Pastor Rucker could live with it as it was. There is absolutely nothing wrong with beige. "Pastor," I said, approaching the large mahogany desk, "I am Julia Springer Murdoch." "Ah, yes, of course, I know who you are." He stood behind the desk looking shorter and younger than he did when he was in the pulpit. His fine sandy hair was meticulously combed and perhaps gelled to stay that way. "Please have a seat and tell me what's on your mind." He reseated himself before I could move one of the visitors' chairs closer to the desk. "Pastor," I said, "I've just read the article in today's paper, and I am appalled to learn that our church and you yourself are supporting this group of newcomers to our town in their ill-advised project of housing latent juvenile delinquents in a stable neighborhood. And not only is it a stable neighborhood, it is a neighborhood in which some members of our congregation live who have small children. I would like to know by whose authority you have done such a thing." "Why, Miss Julia," he said with a condescending smile, "I've done it by the authority of our Lord. Let the little children come on to me, you know." That almost stopped me, but not quite. "I take that to mean that the session has not approved it? Is that correct?" "Well," he said with a smile, "they will. Fact of the matter, though, I've discussed it with two or three of the elders, and they're most supportive. I'll be presenting the total program at the regular session meeting next week." "So you've discussed it with a few elders, but not with any of our members who will be directly affected. I am speaking of the Pickens family, Mrs. Helen Stroud, and Sam and myself, all members of this church, and all directly affected by the close proximity of that house and its problematic inhabitants." "Miss Julia," the pastor said with a small sigh, "we must all be willing to sacrifice for others. Although I am sure that the house will be well run and that the children in it well supervised, you need have no worries." "Now," he said, scooting his chair closer to the desk as if he had a point he wanted to make, "since you are here, there is something I'd like to discuss with you. I'm selecting several members to represent us on a relocation committee which has been formed by several like-minded churches. Would you be interested in doing that?" "Relocation? Of whom and to where?" Then I suddenly understood. "Oh, you mean to relocate the homes for teens?" "Yes, indeed. I would be delighted to help find a more suitable place." He turned his head and with a condescending smile said, "No, that isn't what I have in mind. We, and I'm sure I can include you and Sam in this, are most concerned about the displaced people in the war-torn areas of the world. An active and highly committed ecumenical group is making plans to accept a few of those families to relocate here at Abbott County. I was too stunned to answer immediately, but finally managed to ask, "Displaced Christians?" "Oh, Miss Julia," he said, shaking his head as if disappointed in my response, "we mustn't judge people on the basis of their faith."
"Isn't that what's being done too, Christians?"
He discounted my question with an abrupt shake of his head. "But it's not our way to do something simply because someone else does it. Now, I would love to continue our conversation, but I'm due to make a hospital visit. Please think over what I've said, and remember, Miss Julia, we must ask ourselves in all situations this one important question. What would Jesus do?" And he ushered me, temporarily speechless, out the door. By the time I got to the sidewalk, I was boiling. Not only was he foisting junior criminals on us, he intended to settle among us foreign refugees who probably believed that ecumenical cooperation involved beheading unbelievers, which was one way of getting a consensus. And I fumed. The nerve of the man, quoting scripture to me and referring to Jesus, neither being frequently mentioned from the pulpit. Almost unfailingly, Pastor Rucker took the texts, illustrations, and examples in his sermons from some movie he'd seen. I was beside myself. Chapter 7. The house was quiet that evening, as it usually was, with just the two of us, Lloyd and me, there. With Sam gone for a few weeks, it was a comfort to have the boy in the house. Not only was he good company, he helped fill my empty hours. Lillian had left earlier, leaving the kitchen spotless as she always did, and Lloyd was upstairs doing homework. I was sitting in the library tracing Sam's itinerary on a map of Europe that he'd left so I would know where he was and what he was seeing each day. If I was following the list of his stops accurately, he would be visiting the stunning Cathedral of Chartres with its rose window the next day. I knew he would be thrilled to see it, and I was glad that he had taken the trip, even though his absence left me at loose ends. The television was on, turned low now that the news hour had passed, and good riddance, I thought. Not one report had been the least bit edifying. In fact, just the opposite. Each report only confirmed Sam's stated conviction that the world was going to hell in a handbasket. At the sound of Lloyd's huge sneakers clomping down the stairs, I put aside my gloomy thoughts and anticipated a talk with him. "Miss Julia," he said from the doorway of the library, "want some ice cream? I'm having some."
"No, I think not, but thank you for asking. Come back and talk with me a little."
"Okay." I heard the freezer door open in the kitchen and the clank of spoon and bowl as he dipped out ice cream. In a few minutes he wandered back into the library, holding a cereal bowl full of Rocky Road in one hand and a spoon in the other.
"Man, this is good," he said, licking the spoon.
"What did you want to talk about?"
"Nothing in particular."
"How's school going?"
"Pretty good. Same old, same old, you know."
It was obvious that he wasn't in a talkative mood, so I couldn't steer a conversation that didn't exist around to what I wanted to talk about. So I just asked him straight out. "Lloyd, I have come up against a spiritual problem." His head jerked up from his ice cream bowl as he stared at me.
"A spiritual problem?"
"Yes. And I'd like to hear your thoughts on the subject. What do you think Jesus would do if he lived in Abbotsville and somebody asked him to help bring foreign refugees to this country and settle them here in our town? And keep in mind that these people are in pitiful condition and truly need help, but they are also highly unlikely to want to blend in with the neighborhood. Taking all of that into account, do you know what Jesus would do, or what he'd want us to do?"
"Oh, sure," Lloyd said, scraping the bowl with his spoon, not at all thrown by the question. "He's already told us. Remember the parable of the Good Samaritan? There's the answer. You sure you don't want some ice cream?"
"No, thanks," I murmured, taken aback both by his knowledge and by his confidence in that knowledge. "I'm going to have a little more and then go to bed. Have to get to school early to help Freddie Pruitt with algebra before class. Sleep well, honey."
As soon as I heard him climb the stairs, I made a beeline for the Bible, the one with the concordance in the back, on Sam's desk, and looked up the parable. I had to read it 3 times before the meaning, as it related to my current situation, dawned on me. Then I closed the book, murmuring, "Thank you, Lord." "And you too, Jesus," and went upstairs to bed with a lighter step. I wasn't as heartless as Pastor Rucker seemed to think I was. On the dot of 10 the next morning, I phoned the church and waited for Norma to answer.
"Norma, it's Julia Murdoch. I need 5 minutes with the pastor this morning, and I'm doing you a favor by calling before coming over, since it's difficult for you to adapt to unscheduled visitors." "He's very busy today," she said, stalling as she usually did. "I'm not sure..."
"Norma," I said, exerting great patience. "He asked me a question, so I assume he wants an answer. That's why I want 5 measly minutes of his time, so I can give him what he wants."
"In that case," she said in that sullen way of hers, "you might as well come on."
So I did, marching into Norma's office, confident of being able to put that little snip of a preacher in his place. Then I had to wait while she went through her routine of announcing my presence and waving me in.
"Well, Miss Julia," Pastor Rucker said, rising from the executive chair that almost swallowed him, "how nice to see you again. I hope this visit means that you've changed your mind about serving on the relocation committee."
"Sorry to dash your hopes, Pastor," I said breezily. "My visit today is to answer the question you posed relating to the placement of displaced persons. I will admit that it distressed me until I found the answer, but I'm here to give it to you. I must say, though, I am quite surprised that you don't already know it, being so scripturally well-read as you must be, seeing that you've been to seminary and all."
A slight frown appeared between his fair eyebrows, looking somewhat incongruous with the smile on his mouth.
"The answer to what question?"
"The one you asked to sidetrack me from my main concern. Namely, the inappropriate location of that non-profit home for the homeless. Mind you, I said location, not relocation. And as for my participation in that relocation committee you brought up, no thank you.
And I'd advise you not to take part in it yourself."
"Why, Miss Julia, I'm both surprised and deeply disappointed."
"Don't be. I'm doing exactly what Jesus would do, just as you posed in that question to me yesterday."
"Listen, Pastor," I said, putting my hands on the edge of his desk and leaning forward so he would get the full message. "All you have to do is read the parable of the Good Samaritan, which I'm sure you already have 12 times or more." I wasn't at all sure of that, but I was giving him the benefit of the doubt. "Take note of what that kindless Samaritan did. First of all, the wounded man lying on the side of the road was, I think we're safe in assuming, an Israelite and therefore an enemy of the Samaritans. See how already the parable speaks to our current situation? But notice what the Samaritan does. He binds up the man's wounds, administers oil and wine, then takes him to an inn for something like hospice care. The Samaritan pays in advance for that care, but tells the innkeeper that if more is needed, he will reimburse him on his return journey. Then the Samaritan goes about his business. That is what Jesus tells us we should do. But most important, please take note of what Jesus does not mention. He does not say that the Samaritan took the wounded man into his own home, and he does not say that he made the wounded man his next-door neighbor." "So," I said, standing upright, "there's your answer. We most assuredly should see to the wounds and the continuing care of those displaced persons you're concerned about by sending aid and comfort to them. But nowhere in that parable do I see any indication that we're obliged to take potential enemies to our bosom, that is, to relocate them in Abbotsford. And, I continued, to put my money where my mouth is, I will match any funds you can raise in order to purchase bandages, oil, and wine, or their modern equivalent, to send to them. But I will not lift one finger to bring them here. And I am confident that that is what Jesus would have us do, because he's given us an example to follow, and he's seen to it that I have the wherewithal with which to do it.
For a second I thought I'd left him speechless, but he rallied. "Miss Julia, Miss Julia," he said, shaking his head as if in disappointment, "you must know that we cannot take everything in Scripture literally."
"What? You mean that we can pick and choose what we want to believe and discard the rest? Every man or woman, as the case may be, for themselves?"
"No, Pastor, it seems as if that's what we're already doing, and look where it's gotten us."
"Now," I said, ready to turn for the door, "I've given you the answer you asked for, but you haven't given me what I've asked for. Forget for a few minutes the plight of foreign refugees and think of the plight of some of the members of your own congregation. Pastor, I would like you to use your influence to convince Madge Taylor that the house she's chosen is unsuitable for her purpose and that she should look elsewhere."
"I'm afraid I can't do that," he said, still smiling, although it was getting a little wobbly.
"Then our attorney will," I said, and my head held so high that I almost tripped on my way out. I took my leave.
Chapter 8 Pastor Rucker had almost detoured me by bringing up a problem I hadn't known we'd had, but I had cogently explained my position to him, backed it up with Scripture, and no longer expected to hear another word about a relocation committee. So by the next morning, I was back to concentrating on ousting Madge before she became fully embedded next door to Hazel Marie. To that end, I sat down and wrote a well-thought-out, dispassionate letter to the pastor, intending him to pass it along to the session. In it, I laid out the case against the choice of the Cochrane House in clear and lucent language, so that anyone with any sense at all would readily agree with my conclusion, namely, that the homes for teens belonged somewhere else. Then I took it to the post office and mailed it, feeling that I had done what needed to be done. By that time the day had warmed considerably in spite of the calendar, resulting in one of those beautiful autumn afternoons with a clear blue sky and leaves turned golden in the sunlight. A perfect afternoon for a formal, more or less, visit. I had phoned Binky earlier to report on my conversation with Pastor Rucker and also to get a progress report from her. "Miss Julia," she'd said, "these things take time. You mustn't expect a quick resolution. I'm checking the requirements of the type of group home they're planning, and I'm drafting a letter to this Ms. Taylor pointing out exactly where they don't meet those requirements."
"My word, Binky, don't do that. You'll give them a blueprint of what they have to do. We don't want them to meet the requirements."
"No, don't worry about that," she'd said with just a touch of impatience. "Copies of the letter will go to the members of the Board of Commissioners and to the Zoning Board. Then we'll wait for Ms. Taylor's response, and if her board has a smart lawyer, we'll wrap this matter up in a couple of weeks. But if they have a dumb one, it could be strung out for months. But, Miss Julia, I will tell you right now, they cannot use that house for the purpose they've proposed."
Well, that was a relief. Except it wasn't. I wasn't at all sure that Madge Taylor and Pastor Rucker would quietly fold their tents and slip away. Knowing, as I suspected, that possession was 9/10 of the law, I foresaw more sneaky sleights of hand on their part. It wouldn't surprise me if Hazel Marie and Mr. Pickens awoke one morning to find the Cochrane house fully occupied by a bevy of teenage boys, their pants hanging low and their boomboxes blasting. To forestall that and to get a jump on the city commissioners, several of whom were facing re-election.
I called Hazel Marie to tell her that we should get up a petition.
"Let's divide up the area," I said, "and get the signature of every homeowner for blocks around. That means we'll have to knock on doors and talk to people."
"Where do we get a petition?" Hazel Marie asked, which momentarily stopped me.
"Well, just get them to sign a piece of paper so that you have a long list of names. Then we'll get Binky to word something for us, and we'll attach the list to it."
"Well, okay," she said, but not very eagerly. "I guess I could take the twins for walks in their stroller and stop along the way to knock on doors."
"That's perfect, Hazel Marie. That'll remind all your neighbors that you have little ones next door to that house, and they'll understand your concern."
And probably wonder how in the world she managed to push that huge double stroller with two healthy toddlers in it. I'd stopped offering to take them for walks months ago.
Fully intent on doing my part to fill a page with signatures, I spent the afternoon walking around my immediate neighborhood, ringing doorbells and explaining the impending peril to the peace and quiet that we all enjoyed, making sure to mention the peril to property values as well. Having saved the one I was looking forward to until the last, I walked along the sidewalk on that glorious afternoon on my way to Thurlow Jones's house. It was fairly late, four-ish, an ideal hour, which I knew Helen Stroud would appreciate. Back in the days of making formal calls, one always waited until the lady of the house had completed her morning duties and had her lunch as well as a short nap before one rang her doorbell. When I turned the corner of the block that Thurlow's house occupied, I stopped to marvel at the repaired wrought-iron fence on a brick base that enclosed the entire block. Even more impressive was the magnificent hedge on the other side of the fence, meticulously pruned, yet tall enough to hide all but the dormered roof of the house inside it. Even the gate that opened to a brick walkway, without a blade of grass in it, swung open at a touch. The last time I'd been to Thurlow's, that gate had hung by one hinge. I started up the walk, marveling at the smooth lawn, the freshly painted shutters, none of which hung loose. The three-car garage at the end of the driveway looked practically new, and most impressive of all, every window in the house gleaming in the sunlight without one hint of a smudge. As I approached the front door, I recalled a previous visit I'd made some years past when the house had been in such a shoddy state. I had brought Lillian with me, hoping that her presence as a witness would keep a lid on Thurlow's rambunctiousness. It hadn't, but that's another story. I rang the doorbell, hearing melodious chimes that were starkly different from the banging of the tarnished brass lion's head knocker that had once graced the door. A young maid, dressed in a gray uniform with a white apron and cap, opened the door.
"Yes, ma'am," she said.
"Good afternoon. I am Miss Murdoch, and I have come to call on Mrs. Stroud," I said, handing her the calling card that I'd made sure to bring along. Helen appreciated such niceties. "My card," I said.
"Please come in," she said, accepting it.
"Would you care to wait in the library?" And she motioned toward the room to my right where French doors stood open. I nodded, remembered to close my mouth after noticing two men on ladders painting the deep crown molding of the foyer, and headed for the one room that I'd been in before. What a difference! The room had once been Thurlow's den, or sty, if you want to be more specific. It had been painted a dark green with an overlay of yellowish brown from tobacco smoke. Newspapers had been strewn around, a dog bowl overturned, and a suspicious odor wafted through the stench of cold ashes in the fireplace. Ronnie, Thurlow's old spotted Great Dane, named, I'm been told, for Thurlow's favorite president, had lain sprawled out between a listing sofa and a threadbare recliner, adding his own peculiar reek to the general miasma. I stood for a moment in the doorway, deeply impressed with the transformation. Helen had chosen a pale yellow paint. The room was on the north side of the house, with shiny white on the moldings, windows, bookcases, and fireplace mantel. The furniture was either new or newly upholstered, and a lush oriental rug covered the floor. A lady's desk stood between the front windows, an indication to me that this must now be used as a morning room.
"Julia," Helen said, coming in behind me, "how nice to see you. Won't you have a seat?"
"My word, Helen, you've done marvels with this house. Every lover of fine architecture should be grateful to you. How are you, and how's Thurlow?"
She smiled, and I thought to myself that she looked well, blooming, and in her role as chatelaine of the manor, well she should. Her face with its rosy glow was so different from the strained expression that I'd noticed the last time I'd seen her. But, of course, free-floating anxiety is greatly reduced when you know where your next meal is coming from. And Helen most certainly now knew whence hers was coming.
It didn't take long for us to conclude our business, I to explain the purpose of my visit and Helen to sign the petition.
"We want to improve the neighborhood," she said, putting the cap back on her pen, "not degrade it. Why in the world anyone would want to disrupt a quiet residential area like this? I don't know."
"I don't either," I said, "although you know that we'll be labeled selfish and uncaring of needy children, and that's probably the least of it."
"I'm fully aware," Helen said with a knowing smile, "of how committees pumped full of righteous eagerness to do good can run rampant over anyone in the way. I've been in on that too many times." As, of course, she had. If you'd ever wanted anything done, you knew to ask Helen to chair a committee.
"But," Helen went on, "you should keep this in mind, Julia. I've made it my business to get to know Thurlow's immediate neighbors, something he's never bothered to do, but I've done it because I'm interested in urging a beautification effort by all the homeowners. And if Madge's group starts labeling us as child haters, we should point out that most of the homeowners here are retired teachers, nurses, and social workers. They've spent their lives helping children. And now this Johnny-come-lately group is intent on devaluing their largest and possibly only investment, their homes."
"Excellent point, Helen," I exclaimed, intending to use it as soon as I needed it.
"Now, I know you're busy, but how is Thurlow? Should I look in on him before I go?"
"I'm sure he would like to see you, but I tell you, Julia, he's not doing well. His casts are off, but he was immobilized for so long that he's having to learn to walk again."
Helen stood, and motioning for me to follow, headed for the door. "He's upstairs. I have him downstairs most mornings and out in the yard if the day is pleasant. But he's slow recovering from his fall, and at his age, well, I'm sure you understand." I followed her up the stairs and into a large, nicely furnished room, free of clutter, neatly arranged, all except for the occupant of the bed. Propped up by a number of pillows, bushy-headed and sallow-faced, Thurlow snarled at the muscular man in white who sat by his bed. Helen, smiling, walked up to the bed.
"Look who's come to see you, Thurlow."
He glowered at me, then his face cleared.
"Well, well, if it ain't the Lady Murdoch. What brings you to my bedside, madam?"
"I've come to see how you are, Thurlow," I said, keeping my distance, for he had a tendency to put a hand where he shouldn't.
"And to wish you well. How are you?"
"Oh, just fine, can't you tell? Here I am, laid up in bed with two broken legs, meals of lettuce and carrots, and painful contortions forced on me by this oaf here."
And he flung his arm out at the man beside his bed. Just as I started to repeat some inane get-well-soon hallmark comment, the maid appeared at the door with a message for Helen. As soon as Helen went out in the hall, Thurlow's hand, as quick as a snake, grabbed my arm and pulled me close.
"Get me out of here," he hissed. "She's robbing me blind."
Now, Mr. Thurlow, his minder said, prying Thurlow's hand from my arm, let's not hurt the lady.
Helen called to me. She was needed by the painters, so I turned to leave after a last look at Thurlow, who now lay back, gaunt-faced and subdued, on the pillow. My walk home was disturbed by questions and possibilities concerning Thurlow's welfare, although to wonder about Helen's integrity was as distasteful to me as to wonder about Sam's. And, I reminded myself, Thurlow was not the most trustworthy of tale-tellers. In other words, if he could stir up trouble or get what he wanted, Thurlow could and would tell a bald-faced lie without turning a hair. Still, I mused, it would be well to keep a sharp eye out for any misdoings by either of them. And where, I wondered, was the highly odoriferous Ronnie? I'd not even caught a whiff of his presence in the house.
Chapter 9. As soon as I walked into the kitchen at home, Lillian said,
"That new preacher yo's called and say can you come over to his office?"
"Right now?"
"He didn't say when, just can you come?"
"Well," I said, sighing, "it's supper time, so no, I can't. Is Lloyd home?"
"No, not yet."
"Then I'll call and see when the pastor wants me. I declare you'd think he would have been more specific." I wasn't any more pleased with Pastor Rucker's summons after speaking with him than I'd been when I'd first heard of his call. What he'd wanted was for me to meet with him and Madge Taylor to discuss my problem. That had been the way he'd put it. My problem. "The three of us," he'd said, "can get together here in my office and dialogue. You and Madge can present your differing points of view, and I will moderate. I'm sure we can come to a consensus that way, and everybody can go home happy." "Pastor," I'd said, trembling with anger, "first of all, I am not interested in meeting with Madge at all, much less to dialogue. And second of all, dialogue, mentally spelled correctly, I hope, is a noun, not a verb. And thirdly, there is no way that you can be an impartial moderator. You've already declared yourself, so what you really want is for me to submit to a brainwashing by the two of you." "Well," he replied soothingly, "I would hope that you'd be open-minded enough to at least listen to what Madge has to say. Do you realize, Mrs. Murdoch, that there are more than 200 homeless children in this county?" That stopped me for a minute. 200? Madge isn't planning to house them all, is she? I could picture the Cochran house bulging with children. "One must start somewhere," the pastor said somewhat piously. "Well, tell me this. Where are all these children staying now? Surely they aren't sleeping on sidewalks, are they?" "The legal definition of the homeless is this: individuals who lack a fixed, regular, and adequate nighttime residence. So some stay over with various friends or different relatives, or in shelters if beds are available." "Well," I said, "if the idea is simply to provide a regular, adequate bed each night, then the churches should set up beds in their Sunday school classrooms, none of which is used except for 1 hour a week, and often not even then. That would be a whole lot better than warehousing as few as half a dozen in one small single-family house." "Oh," Pastor Rucker said in a condescending tone, "I wouldn't use the term warehousing." "I would, because I believe in calling a spade, and Pastor, it seems to me that you and Madge are tackling the problem from the wrong end. It's the parents, not community activists, who should be caring for these children. What are you doing about them?"
"Many times it's the parents themselves who are the problem."
"That's my point. It seems to me that you should be working on the underlying problem, not just the results of the problem."
He sighed. "Madge can explain all that to you. Will you meet with us? It would show your good faith if you would."
"My good faith? What did that mean?"
"I'll think about it," I said, and brought that unproductive phone conversation to an end. After supper and after sitting for a while afterward talking with Lloyd, I found I was too stiff from all the walking I'd done that day to take on another visitation. The older one gets, the more one has to pace oneself. Pursuant to that, I called the pastor, who by this time was at home, to tell him I would be happy to meet with him and his confederate some evening later in the week. Ordinarily, I would not call the pastor after hours when he was at home with his family, unless, of course, it was an emergency, in which case I'm not sure I would call him at all. But that was neither here nor there. Besides, he never hesitated to call me at home, and at any hour he was moved to do so. "Lloyd," I said as he came downstairs later, signaling that he was through with homework and ready for a snack, "let me ask you something. If you didn't have a fixed, regular, and adequate nighttime residence, would you want to live in a group home with several others in like circumstances?" His head swiveled around to look at me, a frown expressing his surprise at the question. "I don't know. I guess I never thought about it." And why should he, as he had two fixed, regular, and adequate nighttime residences? On the other hand, he'd been barely 9 years old when his father had expired over the steering wheel of his new Buick Park Avenue parked right out there in my driveway, leaving Lloyd and his mother, for all anyone knew, penniless. Hazel Marie had had no group home to turn to at that time, so she'd left him on my doorstep. An outrage at the first order that turned out to be the turning point of my life. I doubted, however, that Lloyd at that age had understood his mother's desperate attempt to house him, and I certainly was not going to bring it up at this late date. "Well, just think about it," I said, and explained to him the possible influx of homeless boys next door to his mother's house. "Would you enjoy living with 5 or 6 boys you didn't know and be overseen by house parents and counselors from the Department of Social Services?" "No'm, not me. I don't like constant company. Somebody after me all the time. I like to be by myself when I'm studying or thinking or just hanging out."
"So do I," I said, confirming what I'd thought all along.
"On the other hand," he said, "I guess if I really had nowhere to live, that would be better than sleeping on the ground somewhere. But I'd get out as soon as I could. I'd want to take care of myself."
"Yes, absolutely." I was pleased with his answer and wondered how many of those already troubled boys would have the same desire for self-determination. "I think there's still some Rocky Road ice cream if you want it." Still feeling the effects of all the walking I'd done that day, I closed up the house and went upstairs. To forestall stiff muscles, I took a long soaking shower. I'd given up long soaking baths because once in the tub I couldn't get back out. I think I've already mentioned some of the hazards of aging, and that's another one. And to forestall another such hazard, old age body odor, I put at strategic places dabs of Chanel No. 5 perfume, or parfum, if you will, from the sizable bottle that was one of Sam's gifts to me every Christmas. The bottle's getting low, but Christmas was getting near. Lying in bed and missing Sam, I suddenly thought again of Thurlow's dog. Where had Ronnie been? It didn't surprise me that Helen would not have wanted him in the house, but he'd been Thurlow's constant companion for so long, I couldn't help but wonder what she'd done with him. Surely she hadn't had him put down, a euphemism that covered a cold-blooded desire to be rid of an unwanted animal. Having never become attached to either a dog or a cat, I could understand Helen's aversion to having Ronnie underfoot all day every day. He was a lot to have to step around, as Lillian well knew. Still, it seemed to me that Thurlow's emotional condition could improve only by having his longtime companion with him. I mean, Thurlow was having to come to terms with so much that he was unaccustomed to, like a clean house and healthy meals, to say nothing of enforced physical exercises
that to do without his closest friend seemed an unwanted burden.
I didn't get to sleep until I'd decided to learn Ronnie's whereabouts, for I had convinced myself that if Ronnie was gone, Thurlow would not be long behind.
Chapter 10
"Lillian," I said the next morning after seeing Lloyd off to school, "I'd like to take a walk this morning. Why don't you come with me?"
Her eyebrows went up as she turned to look at me. Then she frowned.
"Where to?"
"Oh, around the block or so. I walked so much yesterday that I'm feeling a little stiff today, but a nice leisurely walk this morning should loosen up the muscles."
And because I wasn't above playing on her pity, I added, "But until they loosen up, I don't want to take a chance on stumbling and maybe falling."
"Well, we don't want that. One stove up like Mr. Thurlow is more than enough. Do we need a coat?"
"Maybe a sweater. It's supposed to be in the 70s later today."
It wasn't there yet, for there was a definite nip in the air as we set out down the sidewalk. I knew exactly where I was going, but I wanted Lillian to think I had no particular plan in mind. Lillian was not what you would call a natural animal lover. In fact, she avoided all animals, especially dogs, when she could. I thought it likely that she'd been frightened by one when she was a child. We walked the three blocks to Thurlow's house, but instead of turning toward the gate, I continued along the side of the lot.
"You wouldn't believe the changes that Helen has made," I told Lillian as we sauntered along. "The interior is just beautiful, as much as I saw, and the exterior has been completely updated with repairs and paint and yard care."
"Well, law," Lillian said, "it sure could use some help. I never seen such a mess as Mr. Thurlow lived in, but that's a bachelor for you. He need a good cleaning lady. Looked like he got one in Miss Helen."
"She is that and more," I said, although I knew that Helen would not appreciate the terminology.
"Remember when you and I visited Thurlow to entice him into supporting the poker run? And remember how Ronnie smelled to high heaven? Although, to tell the truth, I sometimes wondered if it wasn't Thurlow himself that smelled."
We laughed at the memory. And Lillian said,
"Remember that night you and me was crawling round trying to see what was going on? And that Ronnie, he come sneaking up on us and wouldn't leave us alone?"
"Yes, and he followed us all the way home and we had to let him in."
I refrained from telling her that Ronnie had found his way into my bed that night and that in my sleep-dazed mind I had thought he was Sam. There are some things that one should keep to oneself.
As we came to the end of Thurlow's block, I said, "Let's turn here and gradually head back. I want to see if Helen has done anything to the back of the house, if we can see through the hedge."
We could, because the hedge wasn't quite as thick as it was along the front and the sides, too much shade. We strolled along behind the three-car garage that, for as long as I had been in town, had never held more than Thurlow's one old car, and that not very often.
"Oh, look at that," Lillian said.
She was holding two bars of the iron fence and staring through them and the thin hedge.
"What is it?"
"It's that old Ronnie, and we just been talking about him."
I poked my face between two bars and saw an enclosure behind the garage, fenced in by a tall mesh fence. There was a sizable doghouse up against the garage, several empty bowls on the straw-covered ground, and Ronnie curled up in a ball over in a corner. Hearing us, his eyes flicked up toward us, but he didn't move.
"Oh, my, he's been exiled," I said.
I knew it. I just had a feeling that Helen wouldn't allow him in the house. He looks so sad, doesn't he?
"Downright pitiful," Lillian said. "He don't have no get-up-and-go, neither. Not like he used to have when he pranced all around the place, knocking over things with that tail going 9 miles an hour."
"Hey, Ronnie," I crooned.
Come over and see us, Ronnie. Come on, boy.
With what seemed a mighty effort, Ronnie unfolded himself and stood. Then he shook the straw from his body and walked somewhat unsteadily toward us, his tail barely making an effort.
"'Law, Miss Julia,' Lillian said, reaching a hand through the fence to pet him. "'He don't look too good. He look mean to me, like he not getting enough to eat.'
"'To me too, Lillian,' I said, noting the easily counted ribs of his chest and his doleful eyes as he looked at us. I scanned his new home. Plenty of room if all he wanted to do was lie down and sleep, but not enough for a romping dog like a Great Dane.
I wonder if that doghouse is heated.
It'll get plenty cold around here with all the trees.
I don't see no electric cord, Lillian said, but maybe they got a quilt or something in there for him.
Well, he's a short-haired dog, so he doesn't have much natural protection. I sighed, knowing how poorly I would sleep throughout the winter with a cold dog on my mind. I'm going to have to speak to Helen about this.
Yes'm, I wish you would. That poor old dog looked half sick to me. He looked like a grieving dog. You know, Miss Julia, that dogs miss humans more than humans miss dogs.
No, I didn't know that.
Yes, ma'am, they do. Why, when they owner dies, lots of times a dog mourns more than a widow woman do. They sit around just waiting for the one they miss to come back. And if a dog gets out, he might go to the grave and set there till somebody come get him.
My goodness, I said, my heart going out to Ronnie, who I could plainly see was mourning the loss of Thurlow's companionship, as well as his former home in front of a dead fireplace and next to his master's smelly feet.
"Helen," I said when she answered the phone, "I meant to ask you yesterday when I was there, but since Thurlow's been out of action, how is Ronnie getting along?"
"Who?"
"Ronnie. You know, Thurlow's dog, the one he's had for years."
"Oh, Ronnie. Well, much like Thurlow himself, Ronnie's not rebounding as I'd like him to, I'm sorry to say."
"Has he been sick?"
"Oh, no, he's just not adjusting very well to having a few boundaries. But you know, Julia, that Thurlow let that animal have the run of the house. And believe me, the house looked it."
"I know. Thurlow spoiled him rotten."
"Yes, he did. But I had to put my foot down and ban him from the house. Of course, I've made sure that he has a comfortable place to live out behind the garage, and on pretty days we push Thurlow's wheelchair inside the fence so he has a little time with his dog."
"That's thoughtful of you, Helen. I'm sure they both appreciate it."
"Well, of course, that animal is just one more thing to take care of, and I have my hands full already. Mr. Harris, that's the groundskeeper, told me just this morning that Ronnie's looking peaked, whatever that means.
Maybe a trip to the veterinarian is in order."
"Oh, probably when I have time to do it. Right now I have painters upstairs and down, and a kitchen designer is due any minute.
Why, Julia, did you know that the kitchen stove is circa 1975, and three of the four eyes are burned out? Now how can we cook on something like that? Thurlow just doesn't appreciate what a mess this house is in. It's like building a new one on the ruins of the old. Ronnie's just going to have to wait his turn."
I thought for a minute, and then, for fear of offending her, asked carefully, "Does Thurlow miss having him around?"
"Oh, my, yes. For the first several weeks, all I heard was him moaning and groaning about Ronnie, until I told him it was either me or Ronnie. He could take his choice."
"Well, obviously he made the better choice, Helen. I don't know what Thurlow would have done without you. You have made such a difference in his well-being."
"I've tried," Helen said without sounding too self-satisfied. "But I couldn't bear the thought of Thurlow stuck in some group home in a room with several other old men in the same condition he was in. And as I reminded him, Ronnie would have been in a kennel with 50 other dogs that nobody could care for. They're both better off here."
Oh, absolutely, Helen. Group homes are fit for neither man nor beast. You have rescued them both from such a destiny, and I hope Thurlow appreciates what you're doing.
But, Helen, I said, then bit my lip before gathering my courage and making the offer, I would like to help if I can.
Would you like me to take Ronnie to the vet just to be sure he's all right? I can have Lloyd go with me, and it's something I think Thurlow would appreciate more than my bringing a fruit basket.
Why, Julia, that's so thoughtful of you, but it's too much to ask. The dog is huge and very hard to handle.
Well, Ronnie knows me. I kept him overnight at my house once when, well, we won't go into that. But if you're concerned that he might be ill, we really should see about him. I'd hate for something to happen and Thurlow to have a relapse because of it.
Oh, goodness, don't even think of that, Helen said with what sounded like authentic alarm.
Well, if you really wouldn't mind taking him to the vet, it would relieve me tremendously. I try to do it all, Julia, but I just can't.
Nobody can, Helen, and your first priority has to be Thurlow.
Yes, she agreed, and the house.
She gave me the name of Ronnie's personal veterinarian, and I promised to make an appointment and be responsible for getting the patient there and back. After hanging up the phone, I studied on our conversation. I could not bring myself to think that Helen would deliberately mistreat Thurlow's dog. But it is a fact that some people do not connect with animals at all, while others think more of their pets than they do of people. To them, a pet has human feelings and attributes, but to others, like Helen, a pet is just something else to clean up after.
Chapter 11. After talking with the receptionist at the veterinarian's office, I should have known that things would go downhill from then on. But I thought, in for a penny, in for a pound, although a pound was not the most uplifting thing to be thinking of under the circumstances. The veterinarian had a cancellation exactly 1 hour from the time I called, his first opening for a week, take it or leave it. Lloyd would not be home from school until much later, so I wouldn't have his help. There was only one person to whom I could turn.
Lillian?
Yes'm?
I don't know how I let myself get into these situations, but Helen has asked me to take Ronnie to the vet. You know how sick he looked when we saw him, and apparently Thurlow hasn't been doing well either. Unfortunately, I happened to ask if there was anything we could do to help, and she asked if we could take him to the doctor.
Mr. Thurlow or Mr. Ronnie?
Oh, Ronnie, of course. He has an appointment in 45 minutes, so would you mind going with me? It shouldn't take long, and Ronnie's accustomed to riding in a car. I don't foresee any problems at all.
Do I have to ride in the back seat with him?
Certainly not. Besides, he'll take up the whole seat himself. There'll be no room in the back for anybody else.
Well, Lillian said, drying her hands with a bounty towel, you can't handle that old dog by yourself, so I reckon I better go, too. You gonna need some help.
Thank you, Lillian. We're both doing a good deed, although I'd just as soon not do it. But let's go get him.
Lillian found an old blanket, which we spread out over the leather back seat of my car and down across the footwell.
Ronnie will fit just fine on the seat, I said, thankful that I didn't have a cloth interior that would soak up odors.
I drove to Thurlow's house and turned into the drive, stopping in front of the garage. No one came out to help us, but Helen had already told me that she would be in conference with the kitchen designer. She was sure that Ronnie would be no trouble. And he wasn't. In fact, his ears perked up as soon as Lillian and I unhooked the gate of his pen. He came right to me and sniffed to confirm who I was, but to be on the safe side, we snapped a leash onto his collar and walked him to the car. The trouble came with getting him in. He didn't seem to have any control over his hindquarters. His front part was willing, but his back part wasn't, and he hung there half in and half out. Lillian and I had to lift his back end and shove him in.
With a great sigh, Ronnie spread himself out over the back seat, rested his head between his front paws, and waited to be driven to his destination, wherever it was. On our way to the vet's office, Lillian looked back at Ronnie and then whispered,
"I don't want him to hear me, Miss Julia, but he don't look good to me."
"To me either," I whispered back. Then, realizing how inane that was, I spoke up. "That's why I don't really mind doing this. Thurlow's in an even worse state, so somebody has to help out." Dr. Marsh, the veterinarian, was a small man, not much larger than Lloyd, who was small for his age. I declare the man looked as if he should be shaking pom-poms at a pep rally, yet he seemed to know what he was doing. He didn't turn a hair when he saw the size of Ronnie, which was about that of a yearling calf, because the office was well equipped to handle large animals. There was an examining table that was similar to one of those automobile hoists that lift a car so a mechanic can stand under it. Ronnie obediently stepped onto the lowered table, then looked around as the table buzzed him up until his head almost touched the ceiling. Thus, Dr. Marsh, much like a mechanic, could easily reach under and palpate Ronnie's nether parts.
"Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, yes, uh-huh."
"Okay, that's it," Dr. Marsh said, talking as much to himself as to those of us who watched. Then, lowering Ronnie to waist level, the doctor, who I thought must have been a dog whisperer, told Ronnie to lie down, and Ronnie did. After further probing, listening, and palpating, Dr. Marsh looked up at us and said, "No wonder this poor dog looks so miserable. He is miserable. Both ears are heavily infected, and that's affecting his appetite and his general well-being. Now, I'll show you how to administer his medicine, which one will be doing it." I looked at Lillian. She looked at me. Finally, I manned up and acquiesced to learning how to do it. Dr. Marsh motioned me to come near the table. He lifted one ear flap, from which emanated a noxious odor, and pointed to the swelling and redness inside the ear. "You really should check a dog's ears occasionally and not let him get this bad." I jerked back, realizing that the doctor was mistaking me for Ronnie's owner. I quickly set him straight as to whom he should chastise for animal neglect, and it certainly wasn't me. "Well, then," Dr. Marsh said, "you are to be complimented for being a good Samaritan." "Exactly," I thought, because I, like the Samaritan, fully intended to drop Ronnie off for someone else to care for. Nonetheless, Dr. Ma showed me how to put drops in Ronnie's ear, one kind of drop for the left one and another kind for the right one, because he had two different infections. "This one," Dr. Marsh said, holding up a small plastic bottle, "is for the left ear, and two drops should go in it every 4 hours for 7 days. And this one," he said, holding up a similar plastic bottle, "is for the right ear, and three drops should go in it every 4 hours for 7 days. And be sure to massage each ear after the drops go in so that the medicine gets distributed. Don't worry, Ronnie will love it. But be sure you don't skip any doses, especially for the first 24 hours. "My word," I said, "somebody's going to be up most of the night." And who, I wondered, would that be? I couldn't imagine that Helen would. She'd stay up all night to perfect a flower arrangement. But to medicate a swollen, oozing dog's ear? I doubted it. And it wouldn't be Thurlow, who couldn't get out of bed at all. Thurlow's minder? Not likely, as he'd be spending more time in Ronnie's pen than in Thurlow's bedroom, which was where he was most needed. I rolled my eyes, giving in to the inevitable. "Mark those bottles well, Dr. Marsh. I don't want to cross-medicate in the middle of the night." "You'll do fine," Dr. Marsh said. "Now, as to his food, I expect he's been getting dry dog food, but I suggest that he get a soft, bland diet for at least the next few days." He handed me a pamphlet showing how and what to prepare for Ronnie's new diet. When the three of us were back in the car, Ronnie stretched out on the back seat and Lillian, seated beside me, said,
"You thinking what I'm thinking?"
I cranked the car and began to back out.
"If you're thinking that there's nobody left to care for that dog but me, then yes, I'm thinking what you're thinking. and I'm about half put out by it. I did, however, open myself up for it by trying to be helpful.
Well, Lillian said, I guess me and Letitia could spend the night so you and me could take turns getting up and giving him that medicine.
Thank you, Lillian, but I couldn't ask you to do that. Tomorrow's Saturday, so it won't hurt Lloyd to lose a little sleep tonight. He can sleep late in the morning.
Before she could answer, we heard an awful retching sound from the back seat.
Too late, I recalled that Ronnie was prone to car sickness.
He's throwing up, Lillian said, trying to unbuckle herself so she could turn around.
From the rearview mirror, I saw